Okay, well, welcome back to our afternoon sessions. My name is Kim Lindsay, as I was talking in the last session, so I'm sure you remember me. But this little bit is basically my testimony about when I got laid off a couple years ago, and I have it written up so that I don't get off track and be talking for a couple of hours. I've been at Parkside for over 11 years, but I've been a Christian for 42 years, since I was a teenager. I know a few of you from various ministries around the church and family members, and I'm happy to be able to help with this workshop today. I got laid off in 2009, near the start of this economic downturn, and this is my story. I was working at the corporate headquarters of Parker Hannifin in Mayfield Heights, in the IT department as a technical writer, which means I was writing the instructions that go with the computer programs that they use internally in the company. I wasn't always a writer. I did a career change into that field in the year 2000, which I'll probably share about in one of the follow-up sessions, and I actually shared that with Chi already over lunch. So that's another good story. But anyway, I'd been at Parker for 6 years, and when the second round of layoffs hit, one of the four writers, and I was the one let go. God gave me some real peace during that time. I strongly believed that my boss couldn't lay me off if God didn't want her to. The sovereignty of God and all that. And since she did, it must have been God's will. And she and I are actually still friends. We see each other every couple of months. We get together for dinner or something like that. But I knew her before I got that job, and that was why she hired me too, so in that bigger context. I also had a real sense that my work for the kingdom of God at Parker was done, and that God had someplace new for me to go and serve him for the kingdom's sake. I just needed to go on an adventure and find out where that was, and I'm not even exaggerating. This actually is what I was thinking. God just enabled me to look at the whole thing very calmly, like a project manager. And Parker dealt very honorably with us. I got a month of severance pay for every year I'd worked, so that was 6 months. They also paid for us to get some very fancy outplacement counseling. It's like job search coaching, similar to what our Career Connections program does. And I've been passing on what I learned to this group and others along the way. In addition to outplacement coaching and signing up for unemployment, I did what I needed to do in my field to make myself more employable. And that's a key word for you to learn, employable, because there are a ton of people who, there are a ton of things you can do to make yourself unemployable. That is, no one wants to hire you. So how you can help yourself become more employable will depend on the field that you are in. For me, being employable was about assembling a portfolio of my writing samples, creating an online presence, including a website with an online portfolio, printing business cards, even personal branding, which was popular at the time, and I understand now it's still popular from the research I've done in the last couple of days. So personal branding. I had brand colors, I had a graphic, and I had a tagline, always remember what it's like not to know. Just 3 weeks ago, I was at a networking event, and I ran into someone I met during outplacement. Like, she got laid off from one company when I got laid off from Parker, and we met at the outplacement. She was excited to tell me that on several occasions, she has told people about my branded portfolio and told them it was a strong differentiator for my line of work. And after 3 years, she still remembered. I got a couple of people that still remember my tagline, and I've had a job for a couple of years now, so it's if you have those kinds of things, if you are in a communication field, it can make a real difference. I also went to a lot of meetings, both job seekers groups and other meetings where I could mingle with people who actually had jobs and that might be able to refer me. And we've talked about that already, so I won't go into that. Every job I've gotten in business has been through networking, including my current job. But there were some other things I did too, using godly wisdom as best as I was able. Since I'm middle-aged, and that could be a drawback, I chose to do a mini makeover. I better pick this up. The bifocals are affecting my reading here. A newer, younger hairdo, a new interview suit, etc. I set myself a budget and spent what I could afford. Again, I looked at it like a business project, like the old adage, you have to spend money to make money. It was an investment, and it did pay off. And to keep my spirits up, I also got a new hobby, which for me was beading. So I have beads. There are a ton of options out there that you can do for cheap or for free. So don't think this isn't possible for you. We humans bear the image of God, and as such, we are creative beings. A creative hobby can really lift your spirits, but you have to be careful and not sink a pile of money you don't have into something that won't make a return for you in the long run. So beading was cheap. That was good. What happened to me job search-wise was not all that unusual. It's always who you know. Be sure you come to the follow-up session on networking and be reading on that subject on your own. Getting out and meeting people and making a positive impression is the most important thing you can do, without doubt. Anyway, I had professional contacts emailing me and calling me, telling me about job openings they'd heard about, and I did the same for them if they were unemployed. One former coworker in particular really wanted to help me. Actually, she remembered me more from a book group we'd both been in than from working together. And you should make note of that. It was the impression I'd made in a networking setting, not on the job, that proved to be the most valuable. This lady was then a hiring manager at a big company, but they themselves weren't hiring. However, they farm out a lot of their work, and she wanted the consulting company to hire me. So essentially, she called her vendor and told them, hire Kim Lindsay to work on my projects. And when I went to interview with Cinecraft, which is my current employer, they didn't even want to look at my portfolio that I spent so much time on. Essentially, the guy said, my client told me to hire you. That's all I need to know. So I started out as a contractor for them, working from home. This is now a different but related field to my previous job. I was now writing training materials and designing computer-based training instead of writing instructions. Anyway, I was laid off April 1st in 2009, and in about 4 months, I had found a job. Not full-time, but steady, and the money was good. Then in December, the same company, Cinecraft, offered me a full-time job in-house, and I took it starting January 2nd, 2010. At that point, I sent my contact, the hiring manager, a potted orchid from proflowers.com as a thank you. So I thought that'll be good to be sitting on her desk and remind her, because she deserved the thanks. And I still have this same job now. But the particulars of my story aren't the most important thing. There's one main principle I want to leave you with based on Romans 12:2. In the ESV, it's, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. And in the Message, it's interesting too. That version says, don't become so well adjusted to your culture that you fit into it without even thinking. Instead, fix your attention on God. You'll be changed from the inside out. Unlike the culture around you, always dragging you down, God brings the best out of you. When you get laid off, the world assumes you're going to be depressed, you're going to be scared, you're going to be angry. But as believers, we don't have to allow ourselves to have the same mindset and the same attitudes that the world has. We have the Spirit of God dwelling within us and the same power that raised Jesus from the grave. We don't have to be like the world expects, like what the news and the magazines and the internet bloggers tell you, or even what other Christians expect. We have the mind of Christ. We can trust in the sovereignty of God and in His love for us, and that He is working in all things for the good of His kingdom. We can have hope, we can have confidence, and we can have a positive attitude of wanting to see what God will do, and patience while we wait until it happens. And believe me, this is something that will hit people in the face. It is such a glaring difference from what society expects. There are things that you can do to make this easier, such as not spending a lot of time watching TV or reading the newspaper or online news sources about how bad the economy is. You need to basically know what's going on in the world, but you should invest your time in doing what you need to do to find a job, not listening over and over again to the same voices talking about how bad things are in the world. Remember that Jesus has overcome the world. That's John 16:33. You might need to choose carefully who to spend time with and stick with people who will encourage you, not drag you down, people who will help you practice Philippians 4. Whenever you have feelings of worry and fear, and of course you will, don't assume like the world does that those feelings must control you. Instead, confess them and look to God for help with your attitudes, and then turn back to doing what you need to do, even if you have to do it over and over again every 5 minutes, all day long. You can do it. Just picture this. There's a hiring manager, like Marty, and he's interviewing two candidates. And this candidate is fearful, worried, and angry at his former employer. And this candidate is confident, trusting in God, not foolish, but calmly hopeful. Which candidate do you think the manager will want to hire? Godly character and walking in his power will make you more employable. And that's the main principle, and it worked for me. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Kim. That's helpful. Okay, we have a lot of ground to cover this afternoon, and Kim's testimony here is a obvious example that, you'll find another opportunity. For those of you who don't have a position right now and you're seeking, it's out there. We were talking about this over lunch, but this might be a surprise to you, because you got caught in downsizing or whatever your circumstances are, but it didn't escape the Lord. The Lord knew it was going to happen before you got there. And we get to that moment in time and we start to doubt, we wonder, and it's fearsome. I was telling someone else that the biggest challenge that I found in all the years I consulted in helping people in career transition was getting through the fear, the not knowing the future. But isn't it comforting to know that the Lord knows our future? So, but we're so prideful that we want to know it ourselves. We got to know everything. But can we just relax and know and trust in the Lord? Well, I can tell you that is not easy to do all the time. You guys know that. You've been there. The most difficult time I ever had in trusting in the Lord for the future was three and a half years ago when my son was diagnosed with leukemia. And thank God, he's doing fine and he's great. Life is good and we're very thankful to the Lord. But that rattles your faith. For a moment, it's like, why would the Lord do this to my 17-year-old son at the start of his junior year of high school? Why would the Lord allow this to happen to our family? How am I going to manage to get through this? How am I going to be a Christian father and a leader of my family and help my wife deal with it? But, I got to tell you, through all that process, God was there, and he brought us through it. And crazy to say, but Michael suffered the grief, but it was a pain. It was a blessing to all of us at the end of the day. He has continued to be able to share his faith and work as a testimony to others. He continually works at Cleveland Clinic and helping other children who have come down with that ailment and helping them see the other side of the sentence. This is no different, really, when you're in a situation where you're looking for that next change in your life or career or that special someone you hope to meet someday, or God knows where it all is. We just have to keep our eyes open. We've got to trust him and keep our eyes open. So the Lord doesn't say, sit back and it'll happen. Just wait. No, the Lord says, you got to do your part too, right? I mean, you can't just sit back and wait for the checks to come in the mail. You got to get out and work. Proverbs is pretty clear about the fact that if you don't work, you don't eat. So that's why we still have to go about the process. The challenge in the whole thing is the fear involved, that we don't know when it's going to happen. Well, I would prefer to think of that as knowing confidently it's going to happen and just waiting to be surprised rather than waiting for the other shoe to drop. Right? That's it. Half full, half empty. So just keep that in mind as you go through this process. But in order to make sure that the employer recognizes that you see the cup as half full, because you could walk into the employer's office and go the woe is me story, right? Here's what happened. That lousy employer of mine downsized me, or whatever the case might be. They don't want to hear that, because someday they could be that employer. So no company wants to know that you beat them up. That company, wherever you were, took care of you for a while, for a season. And nothing is forever. So what we're going to talk about today is to help you put the right face on the presentation, to kind of get your mind right. You know, like they said in Cool Hand Luke, you got to get your mind right, Luke. That's what you got to do. You can't walk into an interview thinking that this person is going to shoot holes in you until they're satisfied. If you understand what's going on truly in the interview dynamics, you'll be far more effective in dealing with it and executing through the process. It's when you don't know, it's the fear of the unknown that, you know, where the lack of strength comes into play. So it says somewhere in the Bible where when I'm weak, I'm strong. So we're all weak. Let's get strong. First, we got to trust in the Lord that He'll get us there. So you got to do that before I talk here. So do it right now. Right now. Trust that the Lord will get you to where you got to go. Okay? That's number one, because none of this matters if you don't do that first. Okay? All right. Let's talk about interviewing dynamics. What I'm going to do here now for the balance of our afternoon is attempt to illustrate to you as best as I can. Okay. I hope these aren't permanent markers. I'm going to try and illustrate as best as I can this whole interviewing process. And we're going to use it throughout the course of the rest of the day here. I'm going to use a variety of illustrations, variety of examples, season it with a few stories. I want you to ask questions if you don't believe what I'm telling you, okay? I want you to challenge it. I'd be happy to discuss that so you fully appreciate what we're going to be talking about. We're going to talk about some general principles of interviewing dynamics first, okay? There are five models I'm going to show you. Then after we're all experts there, and you'll have enough to be dangerous, okay, seriously, we're then going to put you into a situation where we're going to look at one side of the desk, okay, the employer side, and eventually your side of the desk, the employee side, okay? So basic dynamics, then we're going to look at the interview from both sides of the table. You look at that first illustration on your outline there, it's called the communication model, okay? Does that look familiar to anybody at all who took maybe a basic psychology class? No? And the room goes silent. Yes, dear. Familiar? Okay. I borrowed something from something called the Johari window. That sound familiar? Johari? Okay, basically the Johari window is a model of communication. It basically is a way to graph how we communicate. Since the interview is all about communication, I thought it's a good place to start here, which is why I spent some time with this. So, there you go. Gosh, that magically appeared. Did you do that? Thank you. These are the five communication fundamentals that we're going to cover around. The first one is the communication model Johari window. If you look at that illustration, basically it's a window. Think of a window pane, like these windows that have the little cross marks. And each one of these boxes reference some level of communication, okay, each one of them. In the upper left-hand corner there, the first box says open communication. So when you get into an interview process, or when two people communicate under any circumstance, there's a number of things that could be defined as openly communicated. Basically, that means it's known, you can see on the chart there, it's known to the interviewer, but it's also known to you. So both parties observe what's happening. So somebody give me one quick illustration of something that is openly communicated between the two parties when they first meet each other. What's open information? Body language is a good one. It's visual communication. It's what's obvious between the two. Now, it could also be unconscious too, right? Because body language, you're not always aware of your body language, but it is typically you can read their body language, they can read yours. So it's openly communicated between the two parties. Okay, probably one of the best illustrations is just visual appearance, which is kind of like this, but body language implies a motivation behind it. But just image, you know, I'm a boy, you're a girl. You know, I'm tall, you're not. Whatever, okay, obvious things. Another obvious thing probably is the resume, your resume. You know, basically you wrote it, or somebody wrote it for you, and you read it, but they also perhaps already have it. Maybe they asked you to send it in before then, or you submitted it on an online board. All that is just illustrations of open communication, dynamics between two parties. But then, as the example illustrates, there's also information that is concealed information. Look right below it. That's information that is known to you, but not known to the interviewer. Okay, so give me something that would be known to you, but not known to the interviewer.
Your age.
Okay, that's good. That's a good one. That's probably the top one. Reason you left. You probably can't read my scribbling, but this is for me more than you, so I can remember what we said. Yeah, what's the really big one, though? Really, the really big one. Stuff that's known to you but not known to them. How about the problem areas? The real, why shouldn't I hire this guy?
Did we miss this?
What's going on here? So it's really the negative aspects. Things that you know about yourself. Okay, you know about it. And you know you don't like it. And if they heard about it, there might be a problem. So it's really mostly negatives. Negative aspects. All right, the other side of the coin there, upper right-hand corner, information that is known to the interviewer but unknown to you, unconscious. It's unknown to you, but they can see it. We already heard it once. It could be body language, right? Because in this case, maybe you're really nervous. They can read that, but you're not really aware that you're projecting like you're scared to death. Okay? And trust me when I tell you, that happens. Okay, so it's information that is unknown to you, but known to them. Now think about this for a minute. Maybe there's a reason that job's open. See, the window has two sides, right? You could be on the outside looking in or on the inside looking out. So if you're an employer, the information that is hidden could be that I fired the last three people in this job because the people that got to work with are awful. They quit. It could be a lot of things, right? Things that they don't really want to tell you. Well, yeah, this job has a 70% travel, but they're going to tell you 30, but in reality, maybe it's 70. There's stuff that they want to hide from you. So you can also get a sense when you say something to an interviewer and what you said hit them the wrong way, right? The look on their face. They maybe aren't aware that they just gave you a look of disapproval. So there's unconscious on their side. So this known to the interviewer and known unknown to you can be reversed, is all I'm saying. But there's two sides to that window. And then lost information tends to be when two people are communicating and then something happens, like they get a text and they have to stop and look at the machine. And then all of a sudden, nobody can remember what you were talking about. You've been there before, right? In the middle of a conversation, and all of a sudden something interrupts. The phone rings, somebody walks in, and you can't remember where you lost your train of thought. Now, that should never happen to you. It's okay if it happens to the interviewer, but not to you. You should be tuned in to what they're saying all the time. But that's what the Johari window does. It basically gives you a perception, an understanding, that there are multiple dimensions to communications, right? Multiple things are going on simultaneously. As you sit in that room, the employer is hiding certain things that they're not going to openly convey. You're hiding certain things. When you tell them about how you feel about your former employer, sometimes you can't hide it because it's all over your face, that you're angry, okay? You got to be aware that that's going on. So this model at least makes you aware that those dynamics occur. Now, am I telling you anything you don't already know? Did you understand this? Did you think? You must all be aware that we communicate at multiple levels, right? We're all adults here. We all recognize that. So why aren't we using this when we get to the interview process? Why aren't we being more discernful in understanding that they too can be hiding things from you? I mean, and you've got to be, this is like a date, you know, a first date. Is this the person I'm going to marry, or is this person like trouble? You know, what's going on here? And that's really what it's about, because when I interview people, I want them for the long haul. I truly do. I want to get somebody I can invest in, have them stay a long time, promote them. I'm not interested in plugging a hole for 30 days or 3 years. I'd like to keep them longer if I can. So we're not doing that speed dating. We're interested in long-term relationships here. So if you're aware of this communication model occurring, it'll help you. At the end of the day, what is the employer's objective? Be aware. It's written right there for your edification, so somebody can say it. What's the employer's goal? Best candidate for the lowest risk. So think of it like a pendulum, or a pendulum, teeter-totter, whatever. Okay, scales. Best candidate, lowest risk. Okay, those have to be relatively even. Can't be one way or the other. Right? Think about it for a minute. Somebody really thinks, wow, this person is outstanding. They're going to start thinking, well, there's got to be something wrong with this guy. Nobody's that good. On the other hand, if you really look like a risky candidate, you're going to get that job? Probably not. So their objective is to find the best possible candidate, and nobody's perfect. So if the job says 5 years experience and you've got 4.5, nobody comes in exactly with what they want. I've never seen it happen yet. 30 years, I've never seen it happen. The person walk in the door and they're exactly what we want. Never happens. Okay, because that's just not the way the world is. Okay, even recruiters don't do that. They try to do it, but they don't do it. They come close. Find the best candidate at the lowest risk. But isn't that what you're trying to do too? Aren't you trying to find the best job at the lowest risk? Unless you want a risky job. You want to go there and be right back here next month? No, you don't want to do that, right? So you want to find the best fit, just like they want to find the best fit. Like I said, it's dating for long-term relationships. You want to find the right fit. Does this person fit? I keep saying fit because I'm going to go there, right? Fit's critical. You know how you feel, ladies, when you go into that store and you find the perfect dress or the perfect whatever it is and it fits great? That's what the employer's looking for. Got to fit like a glove. Perfect. This is what we want. We have this nirvana idea. Doesn't mean it's going to always perfectly fit in every aspect, but it's got to come close. That's what's going on in their mind. Find the best candidate at the lowest risk. Third factor to think about in this whole dynamic that occurs in the interview is what I call the critical time curve, okay? And you see the chart there. Interestingly, and I won't bother to draw this, you've got it on the page right in front of you. What's the most dangerous part of an air flight when a plane takes off? What's the most dangerous part in flying? Take off and the landing, right? Why? Yeah, that's right. Give that man a cigar. That's exactly right. You got one shot. Well, that's what's happening here in the interview. you're there and the clock's ticking and you got one shot to make this happen. So the most critical time in any interview is the initial 5 to 10 minutes. We tend to blow that off as interviewees. You know, we're more worried about, let's get the questions. Let me show you how wonderful I am. You know, they got to like you first. You know, do I really like this person or what are they doing? The first 5 to 10 minutes is very, very important. And what happens here in the interview process, the dynamic that's occurring psychologically, is this self-fulfilling prophecy and cognitive dissonance. Okay, so fancy words. Who can tell me what a self-fulfilling prophecy is? Say it till you believe it. Well, prophecy implies what? You think you know into the future. You have foresight. Self-fulfilling prophecy. Okay. Now, what's cognitive dissonance?
Cognitive is the way you think.
Cognitive is thinking. What's dissonance? Dissonance is what?
Discord.
Dissonance is a musical term. It's disharmony. Sonance. Okay? So it's a thinking disharmony. So bear with me now here, okay? Cognitive dissonance, self-fulfilling prophecy. We just got through saying the employer's objective is to find the candidate that has the best fit at the lowest risk. Risk adverse is the issue, right? We don't want to have a problem. So when they start the interview, no matter how good you look on paper, no matter how nice you smile, you're dressed right, your resume looks good, in the back of their mind they're thinking, what's wrong with this guy? There's got to be something wrong with this guy. I got to find the problems because that's what's going to kill me. Right? There's something wrong. Let's find out where the problems are. Why'd you leave your last job? You know, how much money do you have to have? Can you do this? Can you do that? Why can't you do this? Why can't you do that? So they're looking for what's wrong with you first. Okay? So they set themselves up for a self-fulfilling prophecy. Right? There's something wrong. So they're trying to fulfill it. They're trying to find out the negatives, and they're trying to ask questions. So the first 10 minutes are so critical that if you screw up the first 10 minutes and you say things incorrectly, you're fulfilling their prophecy. Therefore, there's something wrong with you. That's what typically happens. Now, frankly, it's not like they sat there and they said, well, let's see, I'm going to interview this person, and I learned how to do this because I read about self-fulfilling prophecy. No, I'm talking about human dynamics. I'm not talking about, you know, course 101 and self-fulfilling prophecy. The most effective interviewers don't make any judgments in the first half hour. They avoid judging completely. They let the candidate judge for them. Okay? Let the candidate shoot themselves down. Try to help them demonstrate their capability, but you don't decide before you get the candidate a chance. Okay, let's make it more realistic, okay? Have you ever met somebody in the first 5 minutes you knew you didn't like that guy? Maybe in the first 5 seconds. Why? Why? We're not supposed to do that. We're called not to do that. But it's human nature to do it. So that's what's going on in the interview. They're more worried about making a mistake. Trust me when I tell you, when you hire the wrong person, it's 5 times worse. It's so hard to get rid of the wrong person. Very easy to take the time to do it right the first time. It takes a little bit more effort, more time, I should say. But so the self-fulfilling prophecy is going along, right? The first 10 minutes, they're kind of chit-chatty. But then what happens when everything you're coming back with, you know, all your responses are good? Hey, that sounds good. You know, the guy's thinking in the back of his mind, wow, that's pretty good. I kind of like what he just said. Yeah, she's right. I think we could do that. So what's happening? Cognitive dissonance is kicking in. What they thought was going to be a problem, what they're hearing sounds different. So they start doubting themselves, really. And what happens is, as soon as they start making that decision, there's a moment in time, and you've seen it when you're talking to people, there's a moment in time when they're selling you rather than you trying to sell them. And what's happening here is they've decided they like you. So now they're going to try and run this thing out. And usually when that happens, it's around the first 10 minutes or so, studies have shown. What happens is you start looking good. And you see how that line goes up and it says favorable? Well, basically what happens is unless you make a major error, you can't go back to before you started and make it worse. Even if you make a little mistake, they're kind of giving you the benefit of the doubt. Because now they're judging themselves. Well, I think this guy's pretty good. Well, yeah, we can deal with that. Yeah, that's okay. They got this and this and this. Now, unless you get past the first 10 minutes, that won't happen. So you got to make sure you get past the first 10 minutes, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. Of course, what happens if just the opposite is true? If the cognitive dissonance doesn't kick in, there is no disharmony. This guy's an idiot. And 10 minutes later, you prove him true. You can really never get back again. How many, you've all had interviews before. Have you ever had an interview that lasted 10 minutes? 10 minutes. Usually it doesn't happen. Because nobody will do that in 10 minutes, usually. Unless you really got a bozo. I mean, I've had a couple of those. But usually they'll last 30 minutes. Because even though you know in the first five, are you going to say, get out of my life?
I've had an interview that lasted 5 minutes.
Okay, something just did not click. Right? There you go. And by the way, that's two-sided again, remember. Because you might get there, and you decide in the first 5 minutes, boy, what did I walk into? Uh-oh.
I did. She basically told me, she said, do you like my shoes? And I was like, yeah. She goes, you're hired. I'm not kidding.
Oh, boy. What company was that? Remind me to stay away from them.
No comment.
Yeah, all right.
When I walked out, I felt that there was something wrong. And a couple of days later, she was no longer with the organization.
Yeah, see, and that,
she's on her way out the door, and I was just like, I felt so weird because I called my mom and my husband. I'm like, I just got hired, and I don't know how I feel about it.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Right. And I said, I don't even know what to do. I'm like, and I got the letter from HR telling me about, I mean, like, instantly.
Yep.
I mean,
plugging a hole.
Yeah.
Well, that's my point.
Exactly.
You know, that. You can't make a judgment call on a company. You really can't. You shouldn't in the first 5 minutes. In fact, if you do it my way, you knew before you walked in the door whether you wanted to interview there because you really did your homework. You know, Kim was talking about researching the company, researching the interviewer. You really need to do that before you walk in any door. If you have invested at least 2 or 3 hours doing homework on that company before you interview, you've set yourself up for a failure immediately. Nobody expects you to understand the company thoroughly, but they do expect you to understand something about the organization. Okay? So the point is, in this graphic, that even if you say something smart at about 40 minutes into the interview, you just never get back to baseline. That's what it's trying to illustrate. You know, you never kind of jump back up to the where you started because they already made a decision. They didn't like you. And so we can look at this and we can say this is, you know, half empty. Just as easy as we can say it's half full. And it's a human nature, if you're going in, to be pessimistic, typically, because you don't want to make a mistake for your employer's sake. You don't have to have a personality that makes you negative all the time. You're trying to help your company. So they don't want, you know, you don't want to hire the wrong person. Doesn't mean you're a negative person. It just means you're trying to avoid a problem. That's why they start with that perception. Okay? Again, the best interviewers shouldn't do that. Most of them do. If you find the one that doesn't, you're in good shape because they haven't judged you yet. But you can't take the chance. So that's why you got to deal with the first 10 minutes. Okay? Because you see a little box with the star in it and stuff. You never get a second chance to make a good first impression. Once the decision is made, it's made. It's much harder to bounce back after that decision's made. Any question about that? So when you're in the interview, remember this chart. Just remember that thing in your mind, that little XY graph. What did that mean? Oh, yeah, 10 minutes, cognitive dissonance, self-fulfilling prophecy. Got to be on my best behavior. Real simple, okay? Remember the scales, right? Risk, best fit. That's what they're looking to do. Okay, let's turn the page. Let's go to the next one. Find a balance. Okay, who's been on a teeter-totter once in their life? Raise your hand. Everybody's done it once. Back and forth, right? When's it fun? When it's like this? When it's like this? Is that when it's fun? It's fun like this? What happens when this guy steps off the back of the teeter-totter and you're over here? Right. It's mostly fun when it's like this, right? When you're going back and forth. That's fun. Up, down, kind of smiling. That's when it's fun. Right? Not, you know, right? Well, the interviewer or the interview is supposed to be like a teeter-totter. Back and forth, back and forth. But how many of you actually go about the process of asking questions? As many questions as they ask you. Probably not. In fact, I would venture to guess that usually you don't ask many questions, if any at all. You're interested to hear what they have to say so you can try to show them how wonderful you are. Okay? In fact, probably most of you, if you had your way, you would send them the resume that'd hire you. You know, just hire me. I don't want to go through this back and forth stuff. Oh, that reminded me of the car deal I just negotiated. It was like, oh, God. I told her, I said, look, I'm going to shop this, so do your best now. And then she was surprised the day later when I went to somebody else. It's like, hello? Yeah, okay. So it's a back and forth. So the interview should be an exchange of information. It should be an exchange of information and mutual needs. Mutual needs. You need stuff from them too, right? Right now, you're not worried about that. You're thinking, just get me the job. I'll get what I need. No. You can get a job. That's not what it's about. You'll find a job. You need to find a good opportunity. There's a big, big, big difference. It's a difference between, do you like my shoes? Or will you be here long term? Okay? So you want to find that exchange of information. That's what should be happening. And incidentally, have you ever been... Well, what you don't want to do, of course, is get to an interview where you're the one holding the employer up in the air and you're down here, right? You're on the teeter-totter and you're holding them there. That's very uncomfortable for the interviewer, right? Anybody who's got their butt off the ground like that knows they're at risk, right? It's got to be this way. Everybody's got to be happy. Okay. Point five. So remember the teeter-totter. What's the teeter-totter about? An exchange of information, having fun. Okay. Point five, have a conversation, not an interrogation. Kind of relates to point four, but let's be specific. When you go to an interview, what do you think is more important, answering a question or asking one? Yes? Is that what you said? Answering a question, what's more important? I'm forcing you to choose. Asking a question or answering a question? What's more important? Okay, how many votes do we have for asking? One, two, three, four, five. Okay, everybody, for answering a question. Okay? Okay. Okay. That's it. But whose court are you playing on? So now what's more important, answering or asking? Answering. So when the teeter-totter goes back and forth, somebody's got to start it, right? Somebody's got to be the first one to push. That's the employer. It's kind of like a volleyball game. You want to ask questions, but somebody's got to serve the ball first. That's why there's a picture of a volleyball game. Let's talk about volleyball for a second when it comes to asking questions. When you play volleyball, how many times can you hit it before it has to go over the net?
Three.
Three. No more than three. Remember that. You never ask more than three questions in a row. Don't let them ask you more than three questions in a row. But do you have to hit it three times to put it over the net? You can hit it once. You can hit it twice. But at least three, right? So here's how it should look. Okay? The employer asks a question. You answer it. That's one. Employer asks another question. You answer it. That's two. The employer asks a third question. You answer it, but as you finish your answer, you ask them a question. Because you're having a what? Conversation. As if you let them keep grilling you, they will. Trust me.
Would it would also depend on the type of
interview? Nope. Never does. Sorry.
I'm looking for you to answer a certain amount of questions.
That's exactly why we don't do it. You don't want that job if that's the bottom line. She's saying she's got a structured interview. She's got a structured interview, and her company's saying, here's the 15. I'm going to ask you 15 questions. Don't ask me any questions until we get to the 15. That's a problem right there. Because basically you're enabling the company to make a judgment on you before you have a chance to truly communicate the more effectiveness of your ability to meet their needs at a low risk. They're deciding one way whether you meet the needs at low risk. If you're doing that, I would challenge your company to change the way they do things. What you do is you segue to a question. Okay? Segue. You want to know what a segue is? What's a segue? Yeah, basically, it's another musical term. It's a part between the chorus and the verse, kind of an interlude, a segue. Basically, the person asks you a question, and you respond. Now, they've told you, I've got 16 to answer. Okay, that's fine. But what they're doing is going through a series of canned questions, right? The same ones you ask everybody to see where they are. And at the end of the day, what you're doing is making a judgment on whether or not those 15 come up the way you want them to come up. But you're missing opportunity for better candidates because you're not allowing the person to think through what you just said to come back and ask you more information. So you have to wait until you get through all this. And the assumption is if they don't do that, then they've not been following instructions, right? But if they do it, they're actually hurting themselves. Okay. Trust me. I've been doing this 30 years. The bottom line of the situation is when a person allows the employer to take control of the teeter-totter for any length of time, you're going to have a problem. It's not going to turn out well, typically. Something's wrong there. So I would challenge you, and we can take it offline. I'd be happy to debate it with you.
Oh, it's not a debate. It's just when you said to challenge you to throw something different.
Yeah, it's.
And this was throwing something different.
Sure.
From kind of what you were saying as far as.
Absolutely. And I welcome that, but I just want you to understand, I have not seen that be effective in the long term. If you're going to have a set of structured questions, the reason that's there is for the company to be able to discern whether that person fits some kind of stereotype that they have in their mind. And they're missing the individuality of the person involved. They're trying to get it to this baseline of this is the kind of key things we need. And then the hope is, of course, that if you got through all those and it came out relatively good, that you've got a good candidate. But what you really need is somebody that can ask questions through the thought process, the dynamic exchange of thinking. You know, that's what you really need to make sure you get the very best people. So instead of turnover, what's the turnover rate using that process?
Actually, it keeps it really consistent. So I guess we can't.
You mean it keeps the turnover rate consistent?
No, actually, we haven't had a lot of turnover.
Well, that's probably in.
People come and they're really happy. We find the right candidates to fit the job.
To fit the what? The profile you were about to say? Right?
Well,
say yes. I understand that.
I wouldn't want someone that
correct.
Couldn't take a call. That
That's right.
Make sense.
But what I'm saying to you is when you have that situation where you're putting a candidate in a position to just answer the questions.
But it's not like that.
Didn't you not tell me that there's a series of.
There is. At the beginning, I will ask if you have questions. I'll go through a series of questions, but I never say don't ask any questions.
Now you're telling me something a little different. I based upon what you told me, my assumption was you were asking this series of questions.
It's not a three. I mean, you kind of set this up as ask three questions
right.
And then come back and the other person should interject the question.
That's exactly
not
right.
Truly set up that way.
That's how it should be set up, though. My suggestion to you is that it doesn't have to be three. It could be one. It could be two. The point is, when you allow the employer to control the questioning process entirely, which is what sounds like what's happening, and you don't take some control of it, you lose opportunity to sell yourself. You're hoping they're dropping enough lines in your water to catch the right fish. But you've got to show them what kind of fish do you want, find out, so you can tell them what you have. That's the most effective way to go about it. In my experience, that's the most effective way to go about it. What I find is it's far more effective to ask questions in the process. But we're going to talk about this more in a moment. But let's talk about the volleyball for another second. Let's use the analogy to go one step farther. Okay? You ever spike the ball?
Yes.
There's times to ask a spike question. And they're going to spike you, But you got to do it politically correct. You got to be polite in the process. So a spike question might be, Mr. Jones, I'm really excited to be here. You're always going to set up your questions, by the way, with some comments, but we'll get to that in a minute. I've noticed this posting's been out there for some time. Can you give me a sense of how is it it's taken so long for you to find a position? It's been out there about 60 days. Are you being more selective? Help me understand how you have not yet found a position, or why isn't this position being promoted internally? Do you normally have a process of promoting internally? You're asking a tough question because you need to know whether or not they do that in the first place. Do they promote from within? Are they looking for another person to fill a hole for so long? What are they trying to do? Okay? There are more employers out there that are going to take control of you and until they're satisfied they've heard enough than just the opposite. Whatever the best intentions are, progressive, right? Whatever the best intentions are, there are more companies out there that are not interested in best intentions. What they're interested in doing is finding out why they shouldn't hire you. And if you allow them to ask questions and you never give them a chance to hear from you as to how you can meet a need, see, you've got to be able to ask the questions so you can find out what the need is. Okay? Some employers will tell you, here's what we're looking for. Help, give me an illustration as to how you think you can meet our need. That's great because it's open-ended. It gives you a chance to tell them what's going on. But at the same time, you can't rattle on for a half an hour because it's got to be what? A teeter-totter. It can't be a one-sided diatribe. It cannot be. It's got to be. Can't be a one-sided dialogue. Excuse me. It's got to be a conversation. And volleyball gives us the best illustration of that, in my opinion. Okay. No more than three questions. Turn it around. Find out what's going on. Focus on their needs and find out what they are, so you can answer their questions. The sooner you do that, by the way, remember they control the volleyball court. They get first serve. So the first 10 minutes or so, they've got to control. It's their ball, it's their court, it's their game. You can't walk in and start firing off questions. You won't last 5 minutes. Okay? So you've got to let them control first, then start the teeter-totter in the volleyball game. So they can ask one question. You can turn around and ask three if you can join them consecutively. The reason why I put three on the limit is because it does start to get one-sided. How many commercials do you typically see on television, 30-second commercials, back-to-back? 30-second to a minute. Usually 3 to 4, right? What happens when you're sitting there watching a show and 7 commercials go by? What do you do? That's how you feel when you're interviewing and you're being asked 10 questions in a row, or you never get a chance to ask one. Same way, okay? And it's no good for them either. They want to talk too. You just have to share the dialogue. That's all I'm suggesting. And I found that to be far more effective than, you know, than responding to tell them all wonderful things about yourself, or just the opposite, you know, answering all their questions first and then eventually chiming in after the decision's been made. Yes?